most New Yorkers are probably familiar with the state's Environmental Quality Review Process, known by the shorthand of SEQR, which is a study required before starting certain projects to gauge their impact on the environment. And while that review process is limited to the environmental implications of development, the New York City Council recently approved a measure that would apply the same concept to studying the racial and ethnic impact of certain land use proposals in the five boroughs. To discuss the measure, including whether it should be adopted on the state level, we're joined by Alex Fennell, Senior Housing Organizer for the Association for Neighborhood and Housing Development, which works to create affordable housing and thriving equitable neighborhoods in New York City, and is a member of the Racial Impact Study Coalition. Welcome to the show, Alex.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So the headlines surrounding this idea are focused on the land use studies that would be required moving forward, but the measure also includes the creation of a quote-unquote equitable development data tool to assess the current land use landscape in New York City. Why is that an important first step in this process?
I think that it's extremely important step because in land use decision making and in both the state and city level environmental review processes, there is a collection of data and analysis and processing of data. And that's usually undertaken by a certain number of consultants that tend to sort of dominate the field. But there are a lot of concerns and have consistently been concerns among communities that there might be, I would say, a bias in both the way that the environmental review technical manual is written and also in the way that these reports are processed. So creating the equitable development tool, which will be produced and published annually and will include information about the demographic conditions, household economic security, neighborhood quality of life, housing security, housing production, and a displacement risk index, will be produced at the hyper-local neighborhood level, the borough level, and the citywide level. And so that creates a baseline and a common language for having discussions and really roots everyone in the same context for land use decision making. This tool also will be, as I said, produced every year and updated annually, which will provide this sort of information to communities really before the land use process even begins. And one of the challenges we've seen most persistently in rezonings within the five boroughs is that communities are sort of the last ones to know about proposed changes and receive information about how their communities will likely be affected really late in the land use process. So having this information publicly available for the entire city on a consistent basis will give communities that are vulnerable or communities that are thriving more information and a better basis to understand what their needs are and the ability to advocate for those needs outside of the land use process, which is really the primary mechanism we currently have for communities getting capital investment or much needed resources.
So let's turn to the studies then. When would they be required, for example?
I guess in terms of timeline in the land use process, they're right at the beginning, right after certification, 15 days after certification. And then for what types of projects?
Yeah.
Almost every type of project will be captured by these new required studies. So this includes both commercial projects and manufacturing projects above sort of a medium threshold, and also manufacturing projects where there's going to be a change in uses. So let's say something that is from heavy industrial to sort of light manufacturing, which was important to capture because a lot of times there are significant shifts in the types of jobs that are provided by those types of projects. So from high paying union jobs with low educational attainment requirements to sort of more white collar jobs, which creates, you know, sort of a ripple effect in economic and demographic shifts. And then almost all residential projects will be included. And this captures both individual projects that we call spot rezonings, which would be not really someone doing a renovation or an add-on to a building, but a significant upzoning to create a new and larger residential building. The threshold is set at 50,000 square feet. as well as neighborhood-wide rezoning, such as those as we've seen over the past couple of decades in the past few mayoral administrations. So it was really important to the coalition to capture those individual rezonings as well. That's often where we see the most value and the most affordable units extracted from concessions to communities. And also it was really important that both in both neighborhood and spot rezonings or single sort of building rezonings, that this process looks at, and these reports look at both the affordable units that will be created, but also at the market rate units, which we have seen have had probably more of an impact in demographic changes in community and contributing to racialized displacement. The market rate units tend to have more of an effect on that than the affordable units. So there have been other proposals and other studies that sort of just look at the affordable units in a silo. But this proposal and these studies will look at projects in their totality.
And what could be the ramification of one of these studies? For example, could they stop a project from happening, or are they more advisory than that?
Well, these reports are disclosures. So there's nothing in the report that would necessarily stop a project. And that was very intentional. There's no sort of, in this process and in these reports, there's not any sort of finding of, let's say, like, this is a good project or this is a bad project. What's really required is from that equitable development tool, that's the citywide tool, the project, whether it's a citywide or a spot rezoning, is required to pull the community profile. So basically lay out what are the existing conditions, what's happening on the ground in this community, in the borough, and in the city. And then to lay out, particularly for residential projects, what types of units are going to be created by this project, who will be able to access them, and most importantly, what are the racial and economic demographics of the people who would likely be able to access these apartments. Then communities and stakeholders can sort of look at how do those things line up? Is this project likely going to bring a benefit? Is there a mismatch? Is this project serving predominantly white wealthy residents in a low-income community of color? And conversely, there's a real opportunity for projects where we see a lot of arguments that are truly disingenuous arguments from folks that don't want affordable housing to be built in their communities, particularly in affluent white communities. These reports would really demonstrate that a project, particularly a project with a lot of affordable housing, could provide access to opportunity and could provide pathways for New York City residents of color to access more affluent neighborhoods. So there's nothing in these reports that would stop a project per se, but it will give communities the knowledge and more leverage in negotiations where we see that there is a mismatch. It will better inform the council members, the city planning commission, the borough presidents, and community boards in their decision-making processes. And it will create an opportunity for the land use process to improve projects. So really, I think the goal is not to block development, but to shift policymaking, to shift land use decision-making further towards equity and further towards acknowledging race in the land use process, which we treat as a race-neutral process, but from its inception until now has never been a race-neutral process. And, you know, when the zoning process was created, was explicitly a racialized process. And so it really just gives us the ability and the language to have honest conversations and to make decisions that are rooted in equity and in the lived realities of community members throughout the city.
So I mentioned at the top that comparison to the environmental quality review process, and that one of the critiques of that process is that it drags on and takes a long time. How do you ensure that these studies are done quickly, but then also meaningfully, so that they are done in time for whether it's city council members or members of the public to have this data so that they can weigh in and, you know, have their say on a potential land use project?
The sort of ease and timeliness was something that was really considered by the Racial Impact Study Coalition, as well as by the city council and the public advocate, Jumani Williams of New York City, in this process. And there was an awareness and a lot of thought put into not creating something onerous for either the city or for private applicants, and not creating really like an undue burden. So that, again, is really the reason why establishing the baseline with the equitable development tool was so important. So essentially what we're asking applicants to do is pull information out of a tool that is provided for the public, but also specifically for them. So it's really just pulling out that data and then listing out the details of their own projects, which for any applicant, private or public, is obviously data and information that they have about the project that they're proposing. There's also a requirement of a statement about how the proposed project aligns with the city's fair housing goals, the city's goals to affirmatively further fair housing, which is a narrative statement. So again, fairly simple to prepare. So there's not really, like in the land use review process, whether it's state level CECRA or the city level CECRA process, there is a lot of complex and methodology that's involved in creating those reports. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of pages long. This report is really the kind of the way we talk about it in a lighthearted sense, is asking people to pull something from a data tool, pull the information that they have about their own project, and staple them together. It's not creating or requiring of the applicant really any analysis. It's really just asking them to situate their project within a larger context. So the criticism of the land use process being time-consuming and expensive, frankly, which is a barrier to communities that want to initiate their own land use actions, is not really an issue for these reports, because they, in the scope of the land use process, in the scope of the documents and everything that's required in environmental review, this is really a relatively simple request and sort of a simple report.
So the program that we're talking about, if it's implemented, it will be limited to New York City. Should this same sort of review process be expanded throughout New York State, or at least to, say, metropolitan areas north of the five boroughs?
This sort of reporting and this sort of consideration in land use decision making is really supported by both the spirit and the letter of the Fair Housing Act. All the way back to 1968, the Fair Housing Act really supports and lends weight to these types of analyses. And this type of process has been implemented, or anything really similar to this, anything that looks at race in land use decision making, has only been implemented in a handful of municipalities throughout the country. And if projects demonstrate that they are not really promoting equity or that they're harming certain communities, obviously that is an issue for development. And sort of maintaining this race-neutral process persistently across the country has really served as a cover for a lot of harm and for a lot of racialized displacement in the past few decades of communities of color. And so not only should a process like this or consideration of race or analysis of the racial impacts in land use decision-making be expanded to municipalities throughout New York State, it really should be expanded to municipalities throughout the country. And I wouldn't necessarily limit it even to large municipalities, because as we've seen, the most racialized policies that we see are in suburban areas through the use of exclusionary zoning or limiting areas to single family zoning, which is oftentimes an effective barrier to keep low-income people of color out of communities. So even in those areas that I wouldn't consider large municipalities would certainly benefit from this type of study to show how those exclusionary policies are maintaining essentially segregation. So there's a lot of value to this process for New York City, obviously, which is one of the most segregated cities in the country. But also there's value in this in most areas of New York State would benefit from this type of analysis.
Well, we've been speaking with Alex Fennell. She is the senior housing organizer for the Association for Neighborhood and Housing Development, which works to create affordable housing and thriving equitable neighborhoods in New York City, and is a member of the Racial Impact Study Coalition. Alex, thank you so much for making the time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Support for the Capitol Press Room is provided by New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals in education, human services, and healthcare.
Join us again for Capitol Press Room, a production of WCNY Connected, Syracuse.